From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Georgia, you're so much more than peaches. A lot of great produce thrives in the soil of our state. In fact, one example, the tomato. It'll be celebrated this weekend at an annual festival in Atlanta. We'll talk about how to grow and enjoy tomatoes here in Georgia later this hour. First, though, let's get your reactions to our conversation on authenticity in music. That's what we talked about yesterday. Musician and author Elijah Wald was one of our guests. He shed some light on why artists like Taylor Swift get so much credit for keeping it real.
I think a big part of authenticity is that inauthentic is something we say mostly about people who we didn't like in the first place. And the people who like Taylor Swift, what was authentic about her was that she was a real girl like them, not a great dancer, not a great singer, not a great instrumentalist. And that was a huge part of her authenticity. It's the vulnerability.
Here are your first thoughts. Joel Cook thought our conversation was limited in scope to mainstream musicians. He tweeted the name of artists who he thinks are authentic, like Atmosphere, Mad Villainy, Immortal Technique, Aesop Rock, just to name a few. And Craig Fluke tweets, to me, authentic in music is Hazel Dickens. Here's a little of the West Virginia bluegrass singer.
Fly away, little pretty bird.
We always love getting your music suggestions and hearing your thoughts. You can reach us on Twitter at OSD Talk and on Facebook, or call and leave us a message. It's 404-500-9457. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. A recent report from the United Health Foundation says Georgia's obesity rate for seniors 65 and older is slightly higher than the national average. And that report suggests it may climb even more over the next two decades. GPB Sean Powers explores what that could mean for nursing homes in our state.
Today's middle-aged Americans will get more unhealthy over the next 14 years and costly to the healthcare system. I'm talking about you, baby boomers.
Just a minute, partner. You can't talk to me like that. Them's fighting words.
Take it easy, take it easy. I'm not making this up. Rhonda Randall of the United Health Foundation predicts that by 2030, we'll see a 55% increase in diabetes and a 25% increase in obesity for middle-aged Americans who by then will be at least 65 years old.
In the past, it had been our senior years were the time that we were worried that we were most vulnerable to develop chronic diseases, and now we're put ourselves in a situation as a nation where we're turning 65 already sick with chronic diseases.
Nursing homes will be hit hard, says Harvard Medical School professor David Grabowski. That's especially true in the South, where rates of obesity and chronic illness are already high. But Grabowski says these nursing homes have a great deal of leeway over which residents they'll admit for care.
As you can imagine, what often dictates whether or not a nursing home resident is admitted is, how costly they're going to be for the nursing home.
Grabowski says obese or bariatric patients are more costly because they need specialized equipment like motorized lifts, larger wheelchairs and beds, and longer needles.
This kind of equipment would need to be acquired by the nursing home and paid for out of the nursing home's bottom line. This wouldn't be covered by Medicaid or Medicare. Finally, think about something as simple as supplies. Routine supplies that this nursing home uses every day, surgical dressing gowns, diapers, syringe needles, all of this would need to be larger relative to what's typically used in a nursing home population.
Grabowski says there are also structural improvements needed to make nursing home buildings more accessible for people. But he says when it comes to this population, there's an even greater expense not covered by Medicare or Medicaid: extra staffing. Nursing home administrator Sherry Underwood says that's on her mind where she works at Fairburn Healthcare Center in Fulton County, about 40 minutes outside of Atlanta.
You got to worry about, be sure they're trained, know how to lift, have enough people. And a lot of times they're just afraid to try to work with these heavier patients. We don't get any more reimbursement for it.
Underwood says her nursing home can take residents that are up to 800 pounds, which is unusual for any nursing facility in the state. She recalls taking in a resident that size who traveled a couple of hours from her home in South Georgia.
Most of the time, or in case of the 800 pound that we had, they actually had to just put her on a mat on the floor of the ambulance. You know, it was very hard on her to make that trip.
That's because there weren't other facilities around that could accommodate someone that heavy. Most nursing homes around the state can't manage anywhere near 800 pounds. Twin Fountains Home is a nursing home in Troup County, near the Alabama border. Administrator Mary Jane Cleveland says their weight limit is...
You know, 350, 360 pounds that are referred, and they are difficult to manage. We've had referrals that we've had to turn away.
And where do they go then?
I really do not know. I don't know who just takes care of the bariatric population, if there is a facility that actually caters to that or not.
I asked Melanie McNeil that same question. She's the state's long-term care ombudsman, and she admits in some cases, overweight and elderly people in Georgia may have to start traveling a long way to find a nursing home that can help them. But McNeil says one place they shouldn't end up long-term is in a hospital.
We know that there are lots of infections and other things that happen in hospitals, not to mention the fact that hospitals really aren't home. And for residents of nursing homes, if they're residents, and a lot of them are, this is their home.
But hospitals may offer a solution, as Georgia and other states prepare for the rise in overweight seniors, says Harvard's David Grabowski.
I think that's one of the ways out of this box downstream, is that hospitals may begin to invest in bariatric units within nursing homes, helping to defray the costs of building these units, only so that these hospitals can then discharge their patients from the high-cost hospital setting to the still fairly high-cost, but at least lower-cost skilled nursing and long-stay nursing home setting.
A possible saving grace as nursing homes review whether to make bariatric care part of their mission. For GPB News, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
As we just heard, many more Americans are expected to turn to nursing homes for long-term care by 2030. And Georgia has a lot of work to do to get ready for that. A report last year by the Kaiser Family Foundation found nearly half of all nursing homes in the state received low ratings for quality care. We wanted to learn more about the problem that resulted in bad marks for Georgia's facilities. So I turned to Robert Burke. He's a professor of healthcare administration at George Washington University. And I also asked Victoria Nguyen of Atlanta to join us. She learned about some of these challenges firsthand when she placed her grandmother in a local nursing home.
The room that was right next door to hers caught on fire. So for us, it was...
A guy with an oxygen tank lit a cigarette.
It was a woman, yeah. I think she smoked in her room, and I think the bed caught on fire. And there was just fire, smoke everywhere, and I found out about it on the news. And so we got a phone call, I think a few hours later, but I found out about it on the news first. And so, of course, we were frantic, rushed over there, could not find her.
And you asked the people that worked there, and they didn't know where she was.
Nobody knew where she was, and she doesn't speak any English. So we didn't know if she ended up in the hospital, if something happened. But all we knew was the fire happened right next door, so we thought the worst, right? So we roamed throughout the whole building, looking in every room just to make sure they didn't move her, and was trying to figure out, well, you know, during that time, we're trying to figure out which hospital she was placed in case she went. We found her. We kind of asked, you know, was everything okay? It was an assessment
done. She's covered in soot.
Yes, all over her face. And we asked, and nobody knew if she was okay or not. But she looked dazed, confused. Of course, you know, all this was happening to her. She was moved around. But we found out, you know, nobody really properly asked her in her own language, Chinese or Vietnamese, to figure out if everything was okay.
Okay, Robert, this kind of story, although it's not among the worst that you see in reports about this, how common is it to have these kind of issues?
It's more common than most people readily understand. I feel sorry for the fire. You know, that's a whole other set of life safety code issues that are very different from the other types of issues that I think that we're also facing in long-term care. And as I listened to the story, one of the things that jumped out at me is that if I just mentioned three elements that I think are really running the entire issue. First is the whole aspect of turnover of staff, especially among the certified nursing assistants in long-term care facilities. We know that the turnover in facilities rates at over 100% per year. So that means the facility is constantly hiring and trying to replace folks that are moving and leaving. And the second is that what most Americans don't realize is that 90% of all direct care provided in nursing homes, especially for the long-term care residents, that's a person over 90 days, are really provided by the certified nursing assistant, who, by the way, its educational minimum is 80 hours of training, period, plus a lot of in-service as they go along the way. But with the turnover, that changes dramatically. So I think the aspect of turnover, the second is the issue of prestige of the job. Many people don't find nursing homes to be very exciting, let alone people who work there. But we've done a lot of work with both nurses and administrators about their jobs and found out that the biggest problem they have in themselves is the aspect of low prestige in the community.
Yeah.
Not too many people think about that as being tremendous. And the last point is pay. I mean, they're paid in most where it's a right to work state and so forth. Is probably minimum wage, right around minimum wage. So put those three things together, and we have a boiling pot ready to boil over and cause all sorts of problems like the one you just heard.
Robert, help me understand a few of the other things that came out in this particular report. First of all, they've used this new star rating, I think, since 2008 to kind of help consumers like Victoria choose nursing homes. And about a third of nursing homes that are certified have ratings of maybe one or two stars, quite low. And then 50% have high ratings, four and a half or five stars. So it's almost as though they're either at the high or the low end of the spectrum. Any idea why that is?
It's all actually a part of how the elements that go into the measurement factor. And the five-star rating is done not as a portrait, but as a snapshot of what's happening at the facility during the time when that snapshot of data collection is taken. So it's a good proximal indicator as to what's happening, but it's not the be-all and the end-all. And I think it really helps in the providers who get the low scores. They get a report of what they really need to do for helping them to get a higher score. For those that are a higher score, it helps the consumer to see, well, what sort of is the average? But I would recommend that no matter what the score is, because, again, it could be a little bit misleading on the day of when the testing was done, is that the consumer really needs to go and spend some time in and out of that facility to see what the quality could be.
Victoria, did you use the star system at all when you were choosing a new nursing home?
So we did look online and found a whole bunch of resources, but, you know, like he was right, it really helped us when we went out to go visit. And to be honest with you, we were really, you know, going during times when people would congregate together to kind of see the diverse groups that were in there, to kind of meet with the providers and kind of ask questions on whether they could, you know, work with someone who's limited English proficient. I mean, there were really great answers, but I think when it comes down to it, it's just really looking at the plans and the trainings that they have in place.
That was Victoria Wynn of Atlanta talking about her experiences with her grandmother's nursing care. We also heard from Robert Burke. He's the Gordon Friesen Professor of Healthcare Administration at George Washington University.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The 8th annual Attack of the Killer Tomato Festival kicks off this Sunday in Atlanta, and no, it is not the B-movie spoof.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes! Attack of the Killer Tomatoes! They'll beat you, bash you, squish you, mash you, chew you up for brunch, and finish you off for dinner or lunch.
This one-day event not only does not have violent vegetables, but it also offers tomato-based treats and drinks from dozens of chefs, and the proceeds go to support Georgia Organics. Here to tell us more about tomatoes in general and how you use them is Drew Boleyn. He's the culinary vice president of Ford Fry and executive chef of Number 246 in Decatur. Ford Fry actually hosts this festival. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why an attack, why a killer tomato festival?
We wanted to get involved with Georgia Organics and raise some money for them, and it just happened to be the summertime, and we all had all of these amazing tomatoes kind of sitting around the kitchen. So the first kind of Attack of the Killer Tomato Festival was born. It's amazing kind of what it's grown into over the past 8 years. It was just a few hundred people around that the area on the west side where Bacchanalia and
right.
JCT is in that little courtyard, and just a few chefs kind of helping out, and now it's grown to, I think, over 40 or 50 chefs and mixologists from around the city.
You don't grow tomatoes, your own.
Yeah, you know, no, there's a lot of farmers around town that grow a lot of tomatoes for us. So I got
a
nice bigger garden.
I think we have one of them on the line. Hello?
Yes, good morning. This is Farmer Cass.
And you grow tomatoes?
I do.
How many tomatoes do you think you grow in a season?
It varies. It just depends on how many plants I do. In the past, I've done as many as 2,500 plants. Last year, I think it was up about 450 plants.
Well, when people say that tomatoes grow well here in Georgia, now look, I have like 5 tomato plants on my front porch, and I shouldn't have planted 5 because they grow so quickly here that I am now giving tomatoes away on almost a daily basis. But what do we mean when we say they grow well? Are we talking about how quickly they grow, or are we talking about taste?
Tomatoes do grow well in Georgia. For the most part, this year, I would have to disagree with a few others that say that they're doing well on their tomatoes, because a lot of us farmers who communicate daily and weekly are all doing poorly on tomatoes this year for a couple of reasons. One is that it's just way, way, way too hot. 95 to 105 degrees out here in the country every day is not good for tomato plants.
But Drew, let me ask you the same question about taste. It's fair to say that the tomatoes that most people will buy in the grocery store are not as good tasting as something that is grown from the seed at an organic farm or something that they're growing in their own pot. Is that fair?
Absolutely. There's no character. The stuff that you're getting in the supermarket, there's no flavor. They're growing those tomatoes. Basically, they're mass producing those tomatoes so that they can pack them and ship them.
And to grow
and
as big as they can.
They grow them. They make them. They make them look bright red on the outside. They're kind of white and no
waxy
soul on the inside. And there's just something about those tomatoes that haven't been refrigerated yet, and they're coming in, and they're still
and
warm
they're
from the sun,
they're
and they're
still
picked while they're ripe, and they're not going to travel very well. They're not going to last very long. You know, to me, a tomato should be so delicious. It's just a little bit of salt on top, and that's really all you need.
So I've been making a lot of salsa because I have a ton of tomatoes this season. What else can I do with my tomatoes that may be unexpected, other than tomato sauce, all the things that we would normally make?
I am married to my wife right now. True story. I'm not making this up because I'm on the radio. Married to my wife over a tomato sandwich that I used to make her every day at Bacchanale. When I used to work for a lady, Annie Quattrano, over at Bacchanale on the west side here. I was a sous chef at Bacchanale, and every day her husband, Clifford, would grow these tomatoes out at their farm, and he'd bring them in, and I'd slice tomatoes, and we'd take this really beautiful warm loaf of sourdough that the baker, she's still over there, Dorothy, she would make it come out of the oven basically the same time Clifford was walking in the back door with the tomatoes, and I would make this aioli with Annie's, or mayonnaise basically, with farm egg yolks from Annie's chickens out there, and we just throw a little bit of garlic into it and a little bit of salt and a squeeze of lemon. And just smear that
on
the bread.
And you wooed your wife with tomato sandwiches.
Every day
Farmer
I made her
Cass,
a tomato sandwich.
Do you eat tomato sandwiches?
Absolutely. If you're not eating a tomato sandwich, there's something wrong with you.
Do you use butter or mayo?
Dukes.
Dukes. Good man.
Okay. Well, this is for our listeners as well. Is the classic tomato sandwich made with butter or mayo? Because people can throw down over that particular question. But let me go back to that initial question of, okay, let's say we've had enough tomato sandwiches. Yeah. What else do I do with it?
My favorite way to do it. So one of my favorite things to do, absolute favorite ways to use tomatoes, and it's really, really simple. To get your cherry tomatoes, the Sun Golds are my favorite. I hit them toss them in a bowl with some really good olive oil, some really good sea salt, a really nice twist of fresh cracked pepper. I go out to my herb garden, I pick some thyme, I pick some basil, I kind of, just the whole stem, everything, just throw it on in there, smash a couple cloves of garlic, toss it all together, and I'm putting a healthy amount of olive oil, because what I'm doing is I'm basically making a salad dressing or some sort of vinaigrette with these tomatoes. And so let's say for 1 pound of the Sun Golds, I'm going to use maybe almost a cup of really good olive oil. And I'm going to toss all of that together. I'm going to put it on a little baking sheet tray, and I'm going to throw it in the oven at 300 degrees, and I'm going to slow roast these tomatoes for an hour and a half. And they're just going to kind of wilt down and get a little bit caramelly on top, but they're not cooked all the way. And what these tomatoes are doing when they're really juicy and at the peak of the season is they're releasing all of that moisture into the olive oil. And so they're making this vinaigrette with all of that acids kind of concentrating that's naturally in there, and you're sort of developing the sugars. These tomatoes that are already sweet, delicious to eat on their own, you cook them a little bit, and those sugars sort of develop and caramelize in there. hey, I'm cooking these for about an hour, and then I'll hit it with just a little bit of lemon juice at the end, and I let it cool down to room temperature. And you can use that on anything. I'll take that, and I'll finish risottos with it. Or I'll take it, and I'll toss it on some arugula and some nice greens from the garden if you still have some arugula kind of growing in the shade in the garden. Take it on a grilled steak and just smather your grilled steak with it. You can do whatever you want to do with this stuff. Pork chop, anything. But it's just so great because you've really developed the acids and the sugars and the tomatoes.
What I mean, during the 8 years of this festival, have you seen things done with tomatoes that really surprised you?
Yeah, and every year we try to take it further. But you know, one of my favorite things in the earlier years with the tomatoes, there were a couple of different things. There was, I think it was Morelli's ice cream did a tomato ice cream. I think that won the festival. It might have been 2 or 3 years ago. They just did this tomato ice cream with sea salt and olive oil in it. And it was fantastic.
Did it just taste like frozen tomato soup or?
No. It just had this really nice richness and just the really balance with the sweetness and the acid from the tomatoes. It was fantastic. I always look out. Somebody's doing ice cream every year at the Tomato Fest, and that's always kind of one of my go-tos. And then these little frozen push pops. I guess it's basically I like the cold preparations because it's about 105 degrees out whenever we decide to have the Tomato Festival in the middle of the day on a Sunday. So I kind of always lean towards the cold preparations. And then the mixologists, they have a blast with it too. You know, another great preparation is to take these really beautiful ripe tomatoes they'll basically puree them and then hang it in cheesecloth and all the water from the tomato drips out. So you have this concentrated clear liquid and they'll do something interesting with all the different
liquids. Beyond the Bloody Mary.
Beyond the Bloody Mary, exactly. That's perfect.
So Farmer Cass, if you are a completely amateur grower that just has a small space to put some things in a pot, what kind of things can you grow fairly easily in Georgia that an amateur might be able to pick up without killing them?
Well, let me just first say that after listening to Chef Drew talk about all the preparation of that food, I'm trying to find something to get the drool off the front of my shirt.
Yeah, it sounds delicious.
Right now, cucumbers are doing really well. It's been very warm. I've got irrigation. They're growing like weeds. I'm getting more production off of cucumbers than I've ever had in my life. You're talking about other plants besides tomatoes.
Yeah, things that are forgiving. Like if somebody is traveling for a day or forgets to water for a day or whatever, are there plants that are sort of more forgiving to the hobbyist?
Absolutely. Okra is not a big water hog. You can water okra once a week or once every 10 days or once every 2 weeks, and it still keeps coming like crazy.
And Drew, okra goes really well with tomatoes.
Certainly does. Fried okra and sliced tomatoes with salt. Perfect little southern dish right there.
What about fried green tomatoes? Is a good fried green tomato made with cornmeal or flour?
Ooh. Okay, so that's a great question because I do a mix of both.
Well, you mix
so
them together.
I do almost 2 parts flour to 1 part cornmeal with about a half a part cornstarch in there. And then we have my favorite spice mix is we have this JCT chicken for our fried chicken, our spice mix. It's basically just a lot of garlic powder and onion powder and some paprika and all that good stuff. And that kind of gets mixed in too. And then they sit in buttermilk for a while into the cornmeal flour mixture with the cornstarch. The cornstarch helps it get extra crispy on the outside. It just wicks away a little bit of that moisture and just kind of hardens up the shell just a touch more. So, yes, I do a mixture of both.
Yeah, I'm going to need to go to lunch after this. Farmer Cass, any more any tips for the hobbyist tomato grower on how to take really good care of their tomatoes?
Well, if you're growing tomatoes, what they call a patio tomato in a pot on the deck or on the patio, make sure that it has enough sunlight during the day, at least 8 hours, if not 10, so that it's not shaded by a wall or, a privacy fence or a tree that, you know, where the sun hits the midpoint of the day and then it's in shade, because the hottest temperatures of the day with that sunlight are what get these tomatoes growing. Keep your tomato watered. Don't overwater it. You're going to make really soft, gooey tomatoes on the inside that a lot of times will just blow up if you're watering it too much. And it's not great for the plant either. And then watch for bugs. If the bugs start hitting the plants, there's a couple of things you can do. One of the things that my grandmother used to do years ago is just take some, like, Dawn dishwashing soap, just a couple of dots, put it in some water, put it in a spray bottle and spray it on the plant, and the bugs will disappear.
Huh.
It's pretty neat.
And so, Drew, now for the hobbyist, for the tomato, what's the easiest tomato preparation? Is it the standard tomato sandwich?
I mean, the easiest, purest way that I do it, we do it at 246, we're doing it right now, is, I mean, we just take a bunch of different varieties of different colors, sliced olive oil, good olive oil. There's this fantastic, it's a Georgia olive oil. I think you can actually pick it up at Whole Foods. Olive oil, great sea salt, Maldon salt, black pepper, and some torn basil out of the garden.
Slice up your tomato and eat it.
Slice tomatoes and kind of go for it.
Do you ever grab a tomato and eat it like an apple?
Yes. Sometimes. It gets a little messy.
Yeah, you need a napkin or tuck it into your shirt. Drew Boleyn is the Culinary Vice President of Ford Fry and Executive Chef of Number 246 in Decatur. Drew, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And expert advice from Farmer Cass. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. The 8th annual Attack of the Killer Tomato Festival is this Sunday night at Park Tavern in Atlanta. Proceeds from that event will go to support Georgia Organics. You can get more information at gpbnews.org. Sports fans in Atlanta are a long-suffering bunch. It's been more than two decades since the city has brought home a championship in a major sport. And barring some big surprises over the next few years, that streak looks like it'll continue for a good while longer. Our producer, Taylor Gant, is one of those weary Atlanta sports fans, and he knows the reputation Atlanta has received as a sports town, and he's got this to say in response.
A few years back, ESPN's Michael Wilbon called Atlanta the worst sports town in the country. He bashed the fans, the way the teams are managed, and really just took our whole sports culture to task. And the depressing thing is that he actually made some valid points. Our town suffers a lot of hate from the sports community at large, but it's not without some justification. Right now, both the Hawks and Braves are currently sitting in the bottom third of their respective leagues when it comes to attendance. And despite the Hawks enjoying two consecutive trips to the Eastern Conference Finals, the team still has trouble filling out Phillips Arena. And as for the Braves, well, do I really need to give a reason? The team is one of the worst in all of baseball after they decided to ship off their marketable assets and turn 2016 into a reclamation project. And although the team is moving into a shiny new stadium next year, you can expect a similar sea of empty seats once the novelty wears off in Cobb County. And let's not forget the Falcons' infamous fake crowd noise scandal from last year, where the team pumped in pre-recorded cheering sounds during home games to try and disrupt the visiting team. For commentators and analysts who already looked down on Atlanta fans, that boneheaded decision just threw more chum in the water. So, what's the solution here? Should we just abandon ship? Maybe try being Patriots or Yankees fans for a while? Look, this is the plain and honest truth. Atlanta is not like most other sports towns, and I think we should embrace that. Atlanta is home to transplant fans from across the world, many of which still hold on to their own sports heritages. We're not like Green Bay or Oklahoma City when it comes to passion for their sports teams, but we really don't have to be. Sports can play second fiddle in the ATL when we have so many different cultural activities to enjoy. Music, festivals, art, and theater. We're not handcuffed to sports as our only means of entertainment. Take that, Green Bay, Wisconsin. And when the games do matter for our local teams, we show up. We sell out for playoff games and big primetime matchups. But when our teams hit laughingstock status, we'll be elsewhere because, simply put, we have options. So if the Hawks ever find a way to compete with LeBron James and the Cavaliers, or if Matt Ryan finally realizes his potential as a star quarterback, or if the Braves decide to stop being utterly unwatchable, Atlanta will be there to support them. But in the meantime, catch a show, grab some dinner, enjoy the city. When our teams are ready to win, we'll be ready to watch them.
That was On Second Thought producer Taylor Gant. Are you an Atlanta sports fan? Which team do you think will eventually bring Atlanta a championship? Let us know by visiting our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. 10 years ago, there was no hotter athlete in America than Michael Vick.
The quarterback was drafted by the Atlanta Falcons, and he quickly became one of the biggest celebrities in sports, also an icon of Southern and hip-hop culture. But Vic's success was soon overshadowed by an animal abuse scandal. Vic pleaded guilty in 2007 to felony dog-fighting charges that took place on his property in Virginia, and he spent nearly 2 years in prisons. Fans in his adopted city were left to question a sports hero that they had idolized. A new 5-part documentary from the Bleacher Report chronicles the rise and the fall of this very polarizing athlete. Joe Yannarella is the executive producer of the film Vic. He's also editor-in-chief of Bleacher Report. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
It's a 5-part documentary now, but as I understand it, this began as another one of the Bleacher Report sort of short films or videos. How did it become a larger documentary?
Well, as you described, it started as a narrower digital-friendly featurette in the 5 to 10 minute range. We were specifically focused on the narrative of Michael Vick and his passion for chess in prison, how he took up the game, how it taught him patience and maturity and strategy and some of the tactical aspects of football that resonated with him. And throughout that, our producer, Johnny Sweet, built a relationship with Michael and some of his reps, and they invited him to go along with them to Frank Beamer's last game at Virginia Tech, who was the coach where Michael was a student there. And then they invited us to accompany them to the state capitol in Pennsylvania, where Mike was lobbying animal cruelty prevention law. And as it turned out, we built a relationship with him over 5 or 6 months, and we got such unprecedented access that we thought this made sense for our first foray as a full-length 50-minute documentary.
So you must have felt that there were things that had not been said. I mean, Michael Vick has been talked about a lot, not only from his just meteoric rise after he became the first quarterback ever to be drafted first overall, first African-American quarterback, I should say, but a lot is written about, you know, the dogfighting charges, his time in prison, even whether or not fans would accept him as he returned to the ball field. So what was left unsaid? What did you discover that you felt was a surprise?
I think what we wanted to offer was holistic perspective. You know, taking all of those different chapters, there was the dynamic athlete that just blew people away. There was this criminal, inhumane act that people couldn't get past and captivated a country. There was the return and the comeback of this athlete again in another chapter. We wanted to give a holistic look at it, and we wanted to revisit removed from that. You know, looking at that whole body of work, looking at the man today, has he changed? What's his perspective? You know, what's changed since this kind of whirlwind of events occurred around this very high-profile athlete?
So let's go back in time before we begin to talk about some of the more recent developments. Remind us of just what an incredible athlete Michael Vick was, because he was and still in many ways is. Can we go back to not just his college career, but then his drafting in 2001 and what he was like on the field?
Yes, he was one of the most dynamic physical presences that ever existed at the quarterback position. You know, his combination of size, speed, arm strength. I mean, there were mobile quarterbacks previous to him, but not mobile quarterbacks who were able to throw the ball 70, 80 yards downfield, run like a wide receiver, elude defensive linemen. It was just breathtaking in his athleticism, and he captured the country and the world of sports with that breathtaking athleticism. And at the same time, he maintained a certain authenticity and realness that attracted him to the hip-hop community, the Atlanta music community. He was very authentic in the same way that Allen Iverson was authentic when he burst on the basketball scene.
So let's hear a comment on this very thing from rapper Capone. He is talking about Vic's connection with hip-hop culture.
Michael Jordan was the greatest of all time, but he wasn't hip-hop. But Mike Vick was every young kid's dream, playing in the slums. He was that relatable. He made you feel like you could play football. Everything Mike did became a metaphor, whether it was I'm quick like Mike Vick, you know what I'm saying? Everything that Mike did became a substance for somebody, an artist to rap about.
And I want to play one more comment. This is from former NFL quarterback Donovan McNabb, and he's explaining why Vick became so beloved in Atlanta and became to symbolize Atlanta.
Atlanta was the bed of hip-hop
beautiful women. It was just a place you go to enjoy. And Mike was the face of Atlanta. And to be honest with you, still is probably the face of Atlanta.
Do you agree with Donovan McNabb there? Do you think he still is in some ways a symbol of Atlanta?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons we decided to do a full length, because there is still a segment of the population that reveres Michael, despite everything that went on and him going to prison, that people revere him both for his athleticism, for his connection to the community, for his perceived coolness. You know, this authenticity about him just connected. One of the other rappers said he was just like us, you know, and Lil Wayne said, you know, at that time, if you made a rap video and Mike did not do a cameo in it, your rap video wasn't very cool.
So then we have to move on to the dog fighting charges and the abuse scandal. And the discovery of dog fighting at his property in Virginia was accidental. Some people forget that. They were looking for drug paraphernalia from someone else and discovered that happening at his home. But once it occurred, it became a huge topic of conversation. And this is something that comes up, obviously, significantly in your documentary. Let's hear Michael Wilbon of ESPN. And he's talking about how you have to take dogfighting, while it's awful, you have to take it into context with Michael Vick's upbringing in the South.
As a son of the South, I know that I've heard about dogfighting long before Michael Vick. And people could be naive about this if they want. What Michael Vick did was wrong, criminally wrong. But he operated in a culture in which that was not all that rare. I remember talking to friends from the South, the Deep South, the Mid-South, during this time, and I'd say, what do you know about dogfighting? I've been around dogfighting scene since I was a kid.
These clips are all from your five-part documentary, Joe. How did people, and even Michael Vick himself, how does he put that era of his life into context?
I think he says, he takes full ownership and says it was wrong. It says he should have known better. I mean, in no way are we trying to defend his actions, but we wanted to provide some perspective and, you know, talk about his upbringing and the apartment complex he lived in where pets weren't allowed, but it was common to have strays that were almost the pets for everyone in the complex, and it wasn't unusual to have dog fighting. And you can't separate the fact, the inhumane and criminal nature of what was done, but it was somewhat accepted in those communities. Perspective-based, Michael looks back and says, look, I made mistakes. I was wrong. I shouldn't have done the things I've done. And he's quite remorseful about it. You know, it's difficult to separate those actions from the seemingly mature, responsible, remorseful person he is today. But at least you have some framing and perspective of what led to that.
It sounds like you have at least become convinced that he truly is a changed man. Is that true?
I never like to say definitively that someone has changed. We spent 5 or 6 months with him, and he, from all appearances, was remorseful, mature, took ownership, blamed no one, talked about becoming an agent of change, talked about turning a negative into a positive, spoke very little about football or a football future, and spoke more about how he could turn a negative into a positive. So during that snapshot, he seemed authentic about it. But always hate to take a definitive stance that someone has changed during a short period of time.
Yeah, I can understand that. Let's play another clip from your documentary. I'm speaking with editor Joe Yannarella of Bleacher Report. We're talking about former Atlanta Falcon Michael Vick and the new documentary that captures his fall from grace. And from that documentary, here is ESPN reporter Kelly Naki discussing. She's talking about the psychology behind dogfighting, but what she's really talking about is why this conviction, these allegations, were so upsetting to so many people.
Dogs want to please their master. Now you're putting this dog in this position where it's going to be physically harmed, routinely, and psychologically scarred, all because it's trying to please you. You're taking advantage of that and abusing it. Like a kid, right? Like a child. I think that people equate what he did with child abuse.
And Joe, one of the things that Michael Vick has talked kind of openly about is that the dog fighting was just one aspect of what he called his I guess, a divorce from reality, that he lost a sense of himself and his upbringing, and all of the attention and celebrity and money kind of made him lose himself. What did you learn about that?
I think that's fairly accurate, Celeste. And Aaron Brooks, his cousin, who was also a former NFL quarterback with the Saints, talked about that in his early 20s, that he was speaking to Michael and saying to him, hey, Michael, you know, life's getting away from you. Things are getting too fast. You're getting in bad situations. You know, it was to the point where Michael was flying back from Atlanta to his home every weekend, even during the football season when he had an off day for this. So he got caught up in a spiral of negative activity that he just felt like he was swept up in and takes full ownership and blame for participating in.
So one of the things I really enjoyed about the documentary is it did remind me, the dogfighting became to so dominate the story of Michael Vick, and that's understandable. But we have in some ways forgotten what an incredible athlete Vick was. Certainly here in Atlanta, he led the Falcons to the playoffs twice. He was selected to 3 Pro Bowls. This is an incredible athlete. But let's fast forward to modern times. And he has now become an advocate for pet safety. He lobbied for a bill that would create misdemeanor penalties for even spectators who watch animal fighting, and then make it a felony for adults to bring kids to fight. And this is a little clip of him serving as an advocate for pet safety.
I appreciate the moment to talk about the very important bill, House Bill 1516, which allows police officers to rescue pets and let their hot cars. I know that I'm an unlikely advocate. I was part of the problem when I was at my lowest. I made a decision to make change, and I stand by that. Now that I can reach people that activists can't reach, I appreciate that.
So how has he then moved forward, do you think? I mean, we know what he was court ordered to do. We know about him serving his time. But how has he personally moved forward from this?
I think he's just become a much more mature, responsible adult. I think during his 20s, he was on a ride of excess, and he did not need to mature because of the circumstances that were around him. And he made incredibly bad choices. I think his prison time was quite sobering for him. He talked about the fact, like, the day he went into prison, having to face his daughter and tell her that he was going away and she wouldn't be able to see him, and realized that it was through no fault of anyone else's but his own. And he vowed that he would never put himself in a situation like that again. So I think there's a certain maturity and sense of purpose that surrounds him today that doesn't necessarily revolve strictly around sports.
Now, Michael Vick is a free agent at this point. What kind of athlete is he now? Has his athleticism or his performance on the field changed?
Absolutely. I mean, at his age and the style of play, he is not the same athlete. And even coming out of prison afterwards, he was challenged to get back to the level he was before. Ironically, he's been known as a backup quarterback candidate that teams want to bring in because he's so mature and he's a real locker room leader and presence that they want to have, which is ironic given all the circumstances that surrounded him. But most teams that are even considering him aren't considering him in an active playing role, but as a backup, knowing he can be a steadying, mature influence around other people in the locker room and step in as necessary. We've heard rumblings the possibility of he could return to Seattle, but he, as stated, it wasn't something he put a lot of emphasis on at this point, whether he was actively going to be playing.
So what are we to take from the story of Michael Vick when we look at other pro athletes, athletes that also might suddenly be confronted with the kind of celebrity and money they weren't prepared for? Is he the kind of cautionary tale that could be useful to other athletes?
Oh, absolutely, Celeste. And I think the bigger question is, does someone deserve a second chance? I think that's for the viewers of the doc to decide on their own. For many people, they cannot separate the very inhumane and criminal act that exists from the man who appears to exist today. For some people, they give the benefit of the doubt for this wonderful athlete they've known and revered. I think everyone has to watch and make their own decisions whether someone who's paid their debt to society, served all the time that was charged with, do they deserve a second chance at redemption to move on with their life?
So and we have about a minute left, but I got to ask you, Joe, is this the beginning of Bleacher Report kind of going the way of ESPN? Are we going to see more long-form documentaries from you?
I think the big question, Celeste, is opportunity-based. I mean, this was such a wonderful opportunity that resonated with our audience that is increasing, that is largely young. And so having a topic within the last 10 years of a dynamic personality and a narrative fit in the digital landscape of how our consumers consume content. So I think we'll look at more opportunities in the future, but I don't think there's any decision saying, okay, now go out and make 6-8 more great documentaries, because then you start to water down the narrative.
That is Joe Iannarella. He's executive producer of the documentary Vic. He's also editor-in-chief of Bleacher Report. You can find all 5 parts of this documentary. They're streaming at bleacherreport.com. Joe, thanks so much.
Thanks, Celeste. Appreciate you having me.
That is our show for today, but we would love to get your thoughts on Michael Vick. Did you think, for example, that his punishment was too harsh? And can you cheer for him now on the football field again? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.